We're going to go ahead and get started again. We were in the middle of the Greeks, and that humans became more aware of the self, or in other words, more self-centered under Greek philosophy. They were able to articulate, I think that's the biggest issue, they were able to articulate it and formulate it as an academic study and something to consider. Not that the spirit has always been around. And both Plato and Aristotle believed that education should be overseen by the state, and that children should be trained in what society considered good. We're seeing that very, very heavily today. To the Greeks, and this is an important point, to the Greeks, the city-state, their center of governmental authority, or what was called the polis, P-O-L-I-S, in which we get our word politics, was all important, and the right of each individual to have his say was viewed as vital in their system. The right of each individual to have his say was viewed as vital in their system. This was in contrasting to the dictatorial king rule and to the system established by the God of Israel. Israel was ruled by God, who appointed a leader, in later times kings. He gave them set laws to follow through direct revelation, and emphasis was upon the family as the divinely ordained unit in the Israelite society. A far cry from the "it takes a village" philosophy that we see touted today. The family was the unit. For the Greeks, family life was de-emphasized, and homosexual relations were exalted over natural relations between husband and wife. Homosexual relations were viewed as a higher form of relationship. Under this system, the role of the mother was diminished. Such philosophies and their impact in the fields of science, literature, art, and ethics, and their continued advancements were considered to be the standard of the learned ancient Western world. With the rise of the Romans, they were quick to assimilate the academic philosophies of the Greeks. This was the standard of thinking of the day in which the Christ Ecclesia was faced during the first century. This was the academic standard, the cultural standard. With the rise of the Christ Ecclesia in the first century, it came into direct conflict with the Greek philosophical influence that dominated the Roman academic and cultural world. Whereas Greek philosophy rejected the idea of direct divine intervention and of moral absolutes, God had directly involved himself in the affairs of men by sending his Son to preach the news of a coming divine and literal kingdom on earth through the means of a suffering and resurrected Savior. This was in direct conflict with the Greek ideal that a perfect society could be achieved by man's wisdom and accomplishments. The confirmation of the Israelite hope through Christ also, and please note this, also set an incredibly higher and absolute moral standard to be practiced, which was at complete odds and completely separate from the practices of the Greco-Roman world or cosmos. The standard set by Christ and his ecclesia was incredibly higher and absolute. It was hard. It was not until the Christian movement was corrupted by the philosophies of Plato, the immortality of the soul, the seeds of Trinitarianism, and Aristotle, no absolutes, personal liberty, etc., It was only at that point that Christianity was polluted with these influences that Christianity began to be widely accepted and would thrive. Not until the first century, the pure form of the apostolic faith was corrupted. It wasn't until it was corrupted that it really began to lay hold of the Roman world. Which is indicated to us by the impure woman of Revelation 12. Clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. Who would give birth or facilitate the rise of Constantine around 300 AD. These Greek influences that were working their way into the thinking and teachings of the first century believers is exactly what Paul and the other apostles were contending with, along with the Judaizing influences of the Jewish believers. This was the philosophy that they were fighting. It was the Greek philosophers themselves that Paul challenged in Athens upon Mars Hill. That's found in the 17th chapter. Why don't you go ahead and turn that up? We're just going to kind of pull some lines out of it, but turn to the 17th chapter of Acts. I believe it was the Stoics and the Epicureans that were the main culprits here. It was the Greek philosophers themselves that Paul challenged in Athens upon Mars Hill, which the 17th chapter of Acts records to us that they spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. No absolute conclusions in their mind, just endless reasoning and theorizing, one idea being as good as the other, except for Paul's. But Paul declared unto them the absolute authority of the one true God, and of the resurrection and of judgment. Their reaction to it, found in verse 32. Some mocked, and others said, "We will hear thee again of this matter." As if it was just some kind of, you know, that's kind of interesting. Maybe we'll follow up at another time. Paul references the Greek ideology and its incompatibility with the wisdom of God in the first chapter of 1 Corinthians. We said we were going to go back there, and we are. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, this is verses 22 and 23. We're told, "For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness." Now, of course, the Greeks would view it as foolishness, as it was not according to man's reasonings and logic as it is today. Same reasons for them to consider it foolish now. Jumping down to the 27th verse, it states, "But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. And God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. And base things of the world and things which are despised hath God chosen, yea, and things which are not, to bring to naught things that are, that no flesh should glory in His presence." And humanism is just that. It is all about the flesh. But there were those within the ecclesia that did not like being viewed as foolish. There were those within the ecclesia that did not like being viewed as foolish or despised. And in order to achieve a degree of respectability in the eyes of the world and preeminence within the ecclesial setting itself, supposedly learned believers, tried to fuse the academic and philosophical knowledge of the Greek humanist into the values and belief system of the Christ ecclesia, with disastrous results. These false teachers were known as Gnostics, or knowing ones, is what it means. Who placed a high value on Greek academic disciplines and their own reasoning skills, corrupting, and please note this, corrupting the epignosis. Now, the Greek word epignosis means exact knowledge. And it's used by the Apostle Peter in the first chapter of his second epistle in regarding to exact knowledge of God's truth. A required exact knowledge of God's truth. This is a commandment. As opposed to the gnosis, G-N-O-S-I-S, which represents general knowledge of humanistic philosophy. Now, gnosis is used in a positive form throughout the New Testament as well, but you have to be very careful when you consider the context of what is being talked about to know if it's being used negatively or positively. Now, Paul and the other apostles and ecclesial leaders had to withstand the Greek influences from within the ecclesia. As Christ warned of the corrupting influences that would arise from within the ecclesia, Paul also referred to such as wolves in sheep's clothing. Now, remember the so-called good intentions of humanistic philosophies. And he warned young Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 20 and 21. Let's go there. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 20 and 21. He states, O Timothy, and this is an exclamation, O Timothy, keep that which is committed to thy trust, avoiding profane and vain babblings and oppositions of science or gnosis, general knowledge, falsely so called. Avoid it. Avoid the vain and profane babblings that are associated with this false knowledge. The Apostle Peter, in the second chapter of his second epistle, in warning of, and please turn there, please, second chapter of his second epistle, in warning of the rise of the false teachers from within the ecclesias, and among many evil characteristics that they would exhibit, these false teachers, starting in the 18th verse, the Spirit through Peter states this, they speak great swelling words of vanity. They allure through the lust of the flesh, through much wantonness. I'm terrible at saying that word, so which means unbridled lust. Wantonness, unbridled lust. Those that were clean escape from them who live in error. Note this. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are the servants of corruption. For of whom a man is overcome, of the same he is brought in bondage. They promise them liberty. Liberty from this oppressive, so-called, this oppressive system of standards. Standards too high. Let's lower the bar a little bit. This is too difficult. You're making it too difficult. Such was the Greek humanistic philosophies in the hands of corrupted believers, which put forth a very appealing and logical argument for the liberty or freedom not to be bound to the high moral standards of belief and practice expected by Christ. They presented it in the form of religion without the restrictions. Religion without the restrictions. Are we not seeing the same exact thing today, whether it be in the churches of the world or whether it be in the brotherhood? Once the damage had been done and the first century ecclesia completely transformed as we move into the second century and especially into the third, it completely transformed into Roman apostasy by the end of Constantine 200 years later. The study of the Greek humanist philosophies went dormant. They went dormant during the Dark Ages. As the Roman apostate system put a lid on all academic and theological and philosophical learning of any kind to preserve their power. Except in the isolated and secluded recesses of the Eastern monasteries in the Eastern Roman Byzantine Empire, based out of Constantinople. The great schism which divided the Eastern and Western churches once and for all, we think of the Roman Church in the West and the Eastern or Byzantine, the Eastern Orthodox. When this was divided in around 1054, this ensured the isolation of Greek reasoning in the East. Hence the term the Dark Ages for much of Europe. That should be a term that we know from our history classes, the Dark Ages. Now, in 1453, the Eastern Roman Empire fell once and for all when Constantinople fell to the Muslims. And for all at the hands, fell once and for all at the hands of the Muslims. And there was a major migration of Greek scholars into Western Europe. They brought with them what is called Greek classical literature and the writings of the ancient Greek philosophers, which helped fuel the Renaissance or rebirth. But they also brought with them, and this is a good thing, they brought with them the ancient biblical manuscripts, which also helped fuel an interest in access to the scriptures for the masses, which also led to the Protestant Reformation. The influx of Greek reasoning into the West was somewhat of a double-edged sword. The great benefit that it had is that it broke the brutal and oppressive hold that the Roman Catholic system had over all thought, religious or otherwise, which ended up overthrowing the political power of the Roman Church. The apparently rational approaches of Greek thinking were a stark contrast to the superstitions and complicated mysteries of Roman teaching. And it allowed for advancements in science, medicines, the arts, and beneficial technologies as men took interest in the pursuit of such things. Last but not least, and the most important, with easier access to more accurate biblical manuscripts and with their translations in the hands of the common people, it allowed for the revival and witnessing of the truth, in part and for a time, against the apostasy. But at the same time, the underlying nature of Greek humanism had been once again unleashed, and the seeds were planted for the ascendancy of human logic and reason to the rejection of or questioning of divine authority, as classical Greek literature and philosophies were embraced and expanded upon. The ideals of Greek liberty, rights, and the general democratic spirit were set in motion in a European environment that was ripe for change. The people of Europe grew increasingly agitated at the hold that the Catholic system had over all aspects of life, economic, social, and religious. Read the 13th chapter of the Apocalypse. As well as the corrupt nature of the governments and kings that supported this system, and which was infiltrated with the Roman priesthood. A spirit of revolution was building as men craved the Greek principles of self-rule and of reason over the mysteries of Rome. Let it be noted that one system was not better than the other. Oppression and apostasy on one hand, and revolution that espouses man's supposed rights on the other, both are of the flesh. But God uses these elements to bring about His will. The spirit of humanistic-driven democratic revolution was sweeping across Europe. But it was in France that this spirit would break out with such bloody violence and totality that it had a prominent place in the Apocalypse. and in God's hands. First, as a tool of retribution and judgment upon the Roman Catholic system, and to bring about an end to its prophesied 1,260-year authority during the late 18th and into the 19th centuries, as foretold in the 11th chapter of Revelation. And in the plan of God as a motivating spirit to bring the nations against Israel in the last days. The French Revolution of the late 1700s was a giant development in the course of world history that unleashed the spirit of what was called liberty, equality, and fraternity, or fraternity, which means the brotherhood of man. This was unleashed upon the European stage in such a violent and unabashed way. The American Revolution of 1776 was also a manifestation of the spirit of humanism. But it attempted to surround its purpose of religious freedom and representative rule upon biblical Judeo-Christian principles. But it's still a system dependent on capitalism that is of the world and not in harmony with the hope of God's kingdom. Whereas the spirit of the French Revolution rejected God altogether and exalted reason as the only thing worth worshiping, the French Revolution rejected God altogether and exalted reason as the only thing worth worshiping. Man's intellect. His thought process. But even in the U.S. and other democratic nations, the fleshly force and the logical conclusion of humanistic thinking has and is overpowering any respect for God or His laws, which is why we see the continued assault and suppression of public religious expression. Once the proverbial genie is let out of the bottle, there is no putting it back. And we're not going to really get into it, but I think if you look at some of the writings of the so-called founding fathers, they understood this. They understood that there was a limit to how far the American democratic experiment would go. Now, this spirit is further elaborated upon in the 16th chapter of Revelation. Let's turn there, the 16th chapter of Revelation. We know a lot of you have done much study with this, and there's a lot more that can be dug into, but we're going to include this more as a summary than anything. This spirit is further elaborated upon in the 16th chapter of Revelation and labeled an unclean, frog-like spirit. An unclean, frog-like spirit. Verse 13. Actually, a very fitting verse for that, considering that 13 in the Scriptures is usually the number of rebellion. That which is unclean is polluted with the influence of sin's flesh. The frog is the ancient designation of the French as a representation of the marshlands they originated from. There is evidence of the symbol going back to at least the 400s A.D. Clovis, the first king, and this is Clovis up there, Clovis, the first king to unite the Frankish tribes under one rule, and who himself was converted to Catholicism in 1496, bore three frogs on his official military banners and on his shield, along with three fleur-de-lis, which our Louisianan brethren are exposed to on a regular basis. Now, please refer, and young people, write this in this by this chapter. Write this in. Please refer to Eureka, Volume 5, starting at page 201. Eureka, Volume 5, starting at page 201, and it goes on for a while for detailed exposition of this matter. Now, it's also referenced in Elpis Israel as well, but I really like the way it's laid out in Eureka. The French are referred to by other European nations to this day, and in Canada, as frogs. So it's not. This isn't a the idea of the frogs being related to the French is not a mysterious. It's not a mysterious thing that you have to, you know, just dig and find. It's a very, very common thing. So the spirit, as it breaks forth in belligerent manifestation, is French in nature. Now, as we go through this, you probably think, well, what does this matter? What does it matter to what's going on today? Well, it has everything to do with what is going on today. This spirit, when unleashed by the brutality of the French Revolution, acted as a domino effect upon the European stage, giving rise to continuous revolts and political unrest. A spirit that is very much active and growing today, that is constantly consumed with the cry for equality and liberty and fraternity under the banner of human rights. You cannot turn a newscast on without hearing this cry for human rights. Europe shrouds it in the noble-sounding label of socialism. But we see, as bore out through modern history, that the attempt at equality and the brotherhood of man only leads to more. This is the ironic thing here. This cry for equality, liberty, fraternity, socialism, it only leads to more problems, more injustice, more inequality, more corruption and unhappiness and economic ruin. It prides itself in championing the cause of the oppressed, the underdog, whether such are worthy or not. It is a spirit of constant dissatisfaction, constant cries for equality when such cannot be achieved. And in the end, ironically, it still results in power being in the hands of only a few as they manipulate the emotions and lives of the masses. That is all that the reasoning of the flesh is capable of. It was this spirit that led to the revolutionary Karl Marx and his Communist Manifesto and cry for equality and the rights of the worker. And we understand the great brutality and oppression that came out of the Russian and Chinese revolutions, who espoused Karl Marx. As the communist philosophy was imposed to the death of hundreds of millions of people. So much for looking out for the general welfare of man. This spirit is not finished. And we saw it to a certain degree manifest itself on a very small scale in Ferguson, Missouri, over the last few weeks, if you've been paying attention. The blind and ignorant cry for justice only resulted in the gross breakdown of law and order. Now, Revelation 16:12. And we're going to read this verse, but we also have inserted some paraphrases there to more clearly define what we're talking about. Revelation 16:12. And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up. The shrinking of the Ottoman Empire dominance over the Middle East, including the land of Israel. That the way of the kings of the East might be prepared. The kings of the sun's rising, or in other words, the appearance of Christ and the saints upon the political scene. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs. The humanist, democratic spirit of liberty, equality, and fraternity rising out of the French Revolution. Come out of the mouth of the dragon, Russia, and out of the mouth of the beast, Europe, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, the papacy. For they are the spirits. Spirits are teachings or influences, young people. Teachings or influence. Of devils. Devils is a spirit of madness that will overtake the nations. Remember that Christ cast out devils. We know that they're not real supernatural devils, but it is a sign of madness. And also that they are working miracles or the signs of the times, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and to the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. This battle is revealed to us in verse 16 of the 16th chapter of Revelation as a heap of sheaves in the valley of judgment. the place of judgment upon the nations who come against Israel, influenced by the frog-like spirits into a madness and rage against Jerusalem and Israel. This madness is being worked up today as we see Israel cast in the light as the oppressor of human rights. Israel, who sits in a sea of brutality, is cast by the world in the light as oppressor of human rights and liberty, against what the world tries to portray as the poor, downtrodden Palestinians. Israel is cast as barbaric, the murderers of children, and the thieves and occupiers of Arab lands. While Israel lives in relative comfort and ease, this is contrasted with poverty of the Palestinians. In fact, for the Palestinians, it is a self-imposed poverty and misery. And the success and influence of the Jewish people the world over is viewed as an inequality. It's jealousy. It's a spirit of jealousy. Having what, if you don't have it, then take it from the other guy. It's a covetousness. The illogical nature of it all makes no difference, as the frog-like spirit is a spirit of madness, instigated by the evil intentions of those in power and who desire more power. This is about power, which we see in the manipulative workings of the Russian autocrat, the Pope, and the leaders of Europe. It's not about the rights of the average man. It's about manipulating people for power. And that's how you manipulate people. Promise and liberty. It is the remnants of such a spirit that will reject the overtures of Christ to submit to His iron and absolute theocratic rule and constitution of the restored Israelite kingdom out of Jerusalem. This proclamation is referenced in Revelation 14:6. Flip back to that. Revelation 14:6. The grand proclamation made by Christ and the saints. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, Fear God and give glory to Him. Give glory to Him, not man, to Him. For the hour of His judgment is come, and worship Him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. Such a proclamation is to the subjection of the humanistic, democratic spirit. We must consider that the very nature of the kingdom itself is completely contrary to the ideals of humanism and human rights. Psalm 2, and we're not going to look it up now, and other passages attest to the iron-handed rule of Christ, but according to a mercy and kindness that man cannot now comprehend. Can't, he's too mad. He's too polluted. And of course, we hope for that day to come soon to put an end to all of the horrid things that we see now, and it's just going to get worse as they oppose Christ and the saints. Now, moving on to education, as we quickly went through the issue of history and also into the future of prophecy. As believers, we should no doubt understand the extremely critical nature of education and the great responsibility that goes into molding minds in the correct way. As the Scriptures plainly command, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. But the humanists also understand the importance of molding the mind and also understand that the process is to start young. Education has been referred to as the lifeblood of humanism. That's why we see in public education this constant moving back of when we start kids. We've got to move back further. We've got to move back further. The Head Start program, all these things. We've got to get further back, even into preschool now, that they want to take over that. That was one of the current U.S. president's agendas, was to take over preschools. I don't think he's done it yet. the humanists understand the importance of education. It has also been the stated means as used at the beginning by a small group of Christadelphians, starting in the early 1970s, to slowly turn an entire generation away from our unamended Christadelphian heritage. As it was realized that the older generation was too set in its ways to change, a prominent brother unashamedly stated at this very Bible school many years ago that they would effect change through the young people, and that they did. Education is no doubt an extremely critical matter. The ability to read, write, and have a proficiency in math opens up great potential for us. Instruction in the truth being the absolute benefit, equipping us with the necessary tools to seek after eternal life and to receive the constant instruction of God's Word to direct us in the way. It also facilitates our practical functioning in this world and to simply have the ability to process information or to simply think. But it is this very concept of molding the mind to think and act in a certain way that makes education the most valuable tool in the humanist arsenal. Now, we provide here a few quotes as to how the humanists view education. Our great objective, and this is Orestes Brownson. He was originally an intellectual humanist, mid-1800s. He later turns, ironically, later turned staunch Catholic. I'm not sure why, but I didn't really care to read too far into that. He says, our great object was to get rid of Christianity and to convert our churches into halls of science. The plan was not to make open attacks on religion, but to establish a system of state schools from which all religion was to be excluded, and to which all parents were to be compelled by law to send their children. For this purpose, a secret society was formed and the whole country was to be organized. Did they succeed? That they did. This is the 1800s. Early to mid-1800s. Horace Mann. We actually have a school in our school district that is named after Horace Mann. And probably several districts around the country have a Horace Mann school of some kind. 1796 to 1858. He says, what the church has been for medieval man, the public school must become for democratic and rational man. God would be replaced by the concept of the public good. John Dewey. You also have schools named after him as well. And I didn't recognize, whenever I was going to school and getting an education degree, this name popped up a lot. It's one of those classes that you kind of ignore and get a passing grade and move on. And I didn't really pay attention to what was... But his name is referenced a lot, kind of the father of public education. He says, there is no God and there is no soul. Hence, there is no need for the props of traditional religion. With dogma and creed excluded, then immutable truth is also dead and buried. There is no room for fixed natural law or moral absolutes. There's no room for it. He was the co-author of the first Humanist Manifesto of the 1930s, and he is also an honorary NEA president. NEA is the National Education Association of Teachers, a very powerful teachers union in this country. Very powerful. I'm confronted with it. I'm not a member, just to make it very clear, but I'm confronted with its issues on a constant basis. And finally, every child in America entering school at the age of 5 is mentally ill because he comes to school with certain allegiances toward our founding fathers, toward our elected officials, toward his parents, reminds us of the Greeks, toward a belief in a supernatural being, toward the sovereignty of this nation as a separate entity. It is up to you teachers to make all these sick children well by creating the international children of the future. Chester M. Pierce, very prominent name as well in the field of education. The humanist, in fact, achieved control of public education in the university systems. to instill their indoctrination and methods far beyond what they even could probably imagine was possible. When they started saying these things, I can't imagine them thinking that they could, probably in their minds it was kind of a distant wish. With the push of the teaching of evolution as the answer to everything in place of a creator, with the rewriting and dumbing down of history, with the dominance of humanistic thought in the field of psychology, the humanist agenda was in complete control of what children are taught, how they are to think, and how they are to act. As a matter of fact, psychology and education go hand in hand. We're handed out books all the time for professional development, and it's always from a matter or a point of view of psychology. This grand social experiment, which was to lead men out of the shackles of religion and onto some kind of utopian society, has led only to ignorance, apathy, laziness, lack of responsibility, and moral depravity. No God, no consequences. No rules except for the whims of what society deems appropriate for the moment. The current, and you hear this phrase a lot, the current Common Core push, which attempts to standardize math and language arts, also carries with it a philosophical agenda that emphasizes statism, a life centralized around government, moral relativism, and social liberalism. Brother Adam had a quote. They show me on his phone, and I was going to ask Brother Adam to read that real quick out loud.
Education is a weapon whose effects depend on who holds it in his hands and at whom it is aimed.
Joseph Stalin, yeah. It's a weapon. Education is a weapon, depending on who holds it and to who it is aimed. It is. We ran across a lengthy consideration written by Kenneth Conklin in 1984, who was critical of the humanistic approach to public education. He summarizes what is called the open classroom, and we can attest that we are being pushed to use several of the teaching strategies and approaches here mentioned. Over the last 2 or 3 years, these are things that I have personally had shoved down my throat, for lack of a better term, as to the direction of how we are to educate children. There's a lot of resistance, I will say that, but it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking. And it's been around a while, but it's really starting to garner some momentum. 10 primary doctrines of the open classroom. And I want you also, some of these as we get further on, think in terms of how we apply it in the brotherhood as well, or should not. Number one, subjectiveness. It is best to make statements about yourself and how you feel rather than statements about other people. This is because we cannot be sure about the accuracy of our perceptions. We cannot be sure about the accuracy of our perceptions. So you start forming this doubt in people's minds as far as coming to conclusions about things. Number two, relativism. There is no absolute truth, or at least nobody knows what is true. A little typo there. Or at least nobody knows what is true. Three, narcissism. Focus on the importance of one's self. Or if someone does not like the humanistic approach, it means that there's either something wrong with the person, or that they have some kind of internal hang-up, or they just don't understand. I've heard that from brethren. You just don't understand. This is a higher way of seeing things. This is a higher way of viewing things. You just don't understand. No, I understand. I just don't agree. Anti-intellectualism. It's against critical thinking. Logic is considered the enemy and considered as something that men stand behind to disguise real feelings. They stand behind logic, but the real feelings is what it's really all about. Flexibility. It is considered important to remain open to change. You must remain open to change. Individualization. And this is really where it gets hits home with me. And this is, I'm going through all this stuff right before I start a new school year. It made me feel real good about my career. If all students are doing the same thing at the same time, it is viewed that their individual needs are not being met, which creates chaos, in the classroom. It's all about making sure that each student's education is individualized. Number seven, anti-pre-planned ground covering. It's kind of a weird run-on word there, but that's detailed lesson planning by the teacher violates the student's right to pursue his own interest and leads him to become submissive to authority. That's a terrible thing, being submissive to authority. Meet the needs of the child. The teacher should place primary emphasis upon identifying and satisfying the student's expressed wishes and felt needs. Number nine, student's responsibility for their own learning. The student should choose what, how, and when he wants to study. 10, democracy. The school, or at least the individual class, should operate democratically. As I tell my students, this is not a democracy, it's a dictatorship. And that's the way education is to be run. It is not democratic. It's not what the kids want to do when they want to do it. This is the society that we're living in at this time. We'll go ahead and let the bell ring, and then we'll continue on with this.